Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Sarah Pugh. Sarah is a postdoctoral researcher with a background in molecular mechanisms, biochemistry, biophysics, and genetics. Sarah has become a thought leader in the area of optimal health and longevity. Her expertise in biochemistry, molecular mechanisms, and quantum mechanical effects lend her unique perspective and agency to understand the biophysical interactions between humans and our environment. Sarah is particularly interested and learned in light life interactions, ketogenic style diets, circadian rhythms, and genetic mechanisms. Sarah is also well read in topics at the forefront of scientific inquiry, including morphogenetic fields, quantum fields, hypnosis, telepathy, and more. Her rigorous academic background has allowed her to approach these topics with a broader, more all-encompassing view that has helped her integrate these ideas within a solid scientific framework. Sarah also has a phenomenal podcast of her own, where she expertly delves into the minds of some of the most forward-thinking researchers in the world. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy this podcast. All right, Sarah, thank you so much for coming to speak with me today. I really appreciate it. I've been following your work pretty closely over the last few months. You've arrived on the scene with a bit of a bang, at least in my world. So you've been presenting so many things that I've learned from. So thank you for doing what you're doing and for coming to speak with me.
Oh, thank you. I love doing podcasts, so I'm glad that I'm on another one now, speaking to someone on the other side of the world.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy with podcasts. I've almost never had any podcasts with someone on the same time zone as me. So Australia's a bit of a weird spot between Europe and the States. So it's not too bad, our time difference at all, though.
Oh, yeah, it could be worse because half my mother's a New Zealander, so I'm used to a much worse time zone for having to do family things because the 12-hour ones are the worst. But, yeah, I've noticed there's a big sort of quantum biology following in Australia. With certain countries, it seems to have not spread to so much. I mean, in the UK, it's not as big, but there are a lot of Australians and New Zealanders talking about quantum biology. So it's definitely my field or our field to spread over to that side of the world quicker than in my own country.
Yeah, it's really exciting that Australia seems to be somewhere that this sort of message is quickly growing. And to me, you're sort of one of the people in the epicenter of that. So how did you get involved into this sort of broader way of thinking about health?
Well, it's kind of a really long story because I actually did biophysics as a PhD, but I didn't understand what it would lead to in 25 years' time because I did it in protein folding, which was at that given moment, everything was all biochemistry and genetics. And it was around the time of the human genome being sequenced. And that's when the biologists had thought, oh, when the human genome is sequenced, we'll have the solution to all of life's problems. And that'll be the end of disease. And it was a complete disaster, as in there were far less genes than they were expecting. And venture capitalists lost billions, and we were no better off after the genome sequencing, actually probably worse because we were looking at the wrong genome in a lot of ways, because I was taught about mitochondria in my degree. So I knew that they existed, but I didn't really understand how pivotal they are to our existence. And I suppose back then, the actual nuclear genome was what people thought was important. But then with mitochondria, it's not just their genome, because they make their own proteins to power our cells, and they make water and light, and sort of they're the hub of communication between the sun and the rest of the body. And I think then the connection with how does light drive biology, it came from, I got disillusioned later in biochemistry because I worked on statins after that and heart cells. And even then, I couldn't understand why people thought the heart was a pump, because it's impossible. I didn't know about Dr. Cruz or Dr. Cowan or anything then. I just thought, well, it can't be a pump because it's too small and there are too many blood vessels and it's in the wrong place. And I just got laughed at, but I didn't really say anything. And then I learned then about how scientific research works, about how you can't have anything. It has to all be novel. You can't reproduce old experiments that you thought were rubbish. Nobody controlled anything for light. And that's, I don't think scientists are inherently dishonest. I think if you opened the window and did an experiment with cells, you'd get a totally different answer with a closed window in winter. But nobody's ever considered that idea because we had terrible trouble even amongst ourselves trying to get data to be reproduced. And then I began to thought, think there's, you know, I just want out of this for a bit. But then I went and worked in sort of holistic area for a while, doing Pilates and hypnosis, and I rapidly got back into biochemistry because there was a big demand for nutritional advice because people were told to eat the food pyramid and just got worse. And I already knew about the cholesterol not being the evil thing it was supposed to be, and there were still people eating margarine then and wondering why they were getting worse and worse. So the whole idea of there's something wrong with science and the conventional thinking was already in my head. But even then, when I trained in stuff like Bowen therapy and stuff like that, there was a huge talk about water being really important and how we're chronically dehydrated. So people have known about exclusion zone water long before Gerald Pollack wrote his book. I think the advantage I've got is that there's now too much science to dispute now this fact that we have a water battery in our bodies, that water and the semiconductors has to be what powers us. I mean, Gilbert Ling's work shows that, so it's not ATP. And then more and more work and studies just come out every day on how light influences biology. But this is nothing new either. There's probably 20 years of research about circadian rhythms, and nobody disputes that people who work as airline staff or a pilot, they're top of the list of horrible problems. And that's a mixture of moving time zones, being isolated from the ground, non-native EMFs, and distorted light cycles. And then over the years, as we've got rid of incandescent bulbs and there's more and more screens, there's just more and more problems. And the more I've sort of got into understanding how light drives biology, especially things like mental illness, because that's something that I'm really interested in, it's sometimes literally night and day with people and their moods. That if you just give them blue blockers or ask them to open a window, the anxiety and depression and insomnia can literally disappear overnight. And it can be that simple for a lot of people. And then there are so many other things about grounding that people think it's silly, but then it's actually a very, it's, I think there is the reverse spin magnetic flux effect. So there's a very physics reason of why grounding draws in electrons and how these electrons can fundamentally power us. And nobody refutes that if, when our electrons stop flowing in the electron transport chain or our bodies, we die. So it's all been there under our noses, but nobody wants to talk. I don't know. I mean, either it's so obvious that people have dismissed it, or there's other things like genetics and pharmaceuticals and stuff like that, that's there's more funding behind them. So people just think, oh, it must, there's a new drug coming, there's going to be a new treatment, there's a new surgery, I'll just wait for that. Whereas the solution is much more simple than that. So that's sort of how I got into it. And like every day, I'll learn something new about some kind of wavelength of light or hydrogen water or double helix water or a different kind of grounding shoe or some different way of eating a certain fruit or vegetable at a time of year that's more compatible to somebody's environment. So it's a kind of a work in progress. But on the surface, when I try and explain to, say, my mum and dad, it sounds outlandish to start with. But a lot of the stuff about quantum biology is anybody can test it and do it themselves. And it does actually make a lot of sense if you actually sit down and think about it. And even to people like my parents, if you just say, do you honestly think it's healthy to sit in that kitchen on that laptop with the windows shut all day? No wonder you've got the beginnings of dementia. And all of a sudden, if you go outside for a walk, magically you feel better. So a lot of it is obvious, but in the past, we've just had a lack of sort of science. And now with quantum mechanics, again, getting stronger and stronger in the studies, and also more and more studies on deuterium coming out, the evidence is very hard to argue with. I agree that quantum mechanics can be extremely difficult to explain to lay people, but something like deuterium is actually very simple to explain. Same with something like electrons or water or grounding or light cycles. Lay people can easily grasp the concept of it. I just think it takes a little bit of time to explain it to them, and that's sort of what I'm trying to do. And the good thing about quantum biology is a lot of it's free, so people don't have to invest in anything. They just have to do it.
Yeah, I mean, there's almost an inexhaustible field of ideas that you can sort of pick from when you're thinking about these really broad ideas. And you've touched on so many there, but I have to ask you about protein folding first, given that that's something that you worked on. My understanding is that understanding protein folding is incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult to model using software. And it's contingent on a whole lot of things, and there are all these different configurations, particularly for large proteins, that are, equally viable. So it's almost impossible to tell how a protein is going to fold. Is this true? Is this something that you came across as well?
Oh, you basically nailed it on the head. So the thing is called the protein folding problem because there's something called a protein folding funnel, and it's sort of like a landscape, and it looks like sort of mountains and valleys. So on this landscape, it's not just smooth, it's got like rivers and pathways. So obviously, in the simplistic thinking, the sequence in the amino acids, something must be encoded in that so it knows how to fold. But then when you actually think about with, say, a small protein, these can be modeled because they can fold independently without the assistance of chaperones or other proteins. But really, the protein folding, it's when you we've got in vivo protein folding and protein folding in vitro, and all of the studies are done on in vitro, and it's only small proteins, sort of up to about 400 amino acids, so they spontaneously fold, and sometimes they fold via intermediates and sort of get stuck and go through an intermediate or unfold themselves and then try again. But from a mathematics point of view, it's a bit like, those chess computers, that it's that level of computational complexity. But the problem with it is, again, back then, protein folding was thought, okay, when we solve the protein folding problem, we're going to get rid of Alzheimer's and ALS and Parkinson's and some types, and everything was all about it must be because the proteins are not folding properly. Whereas there are other sort of ideas now that the purpose of ATP in the body isn't to power us, it's to be a fuel to fold and unfold proteins, and the purpose of the ATP is to unfold the proteins so they can participate in the semiconductor system. Because yes, proteins do fold spontaneously, but also the environment inside the cell, it's full of water. And even when I did my PhD, people did say, "Oh, really? It's not the hydrophobic effect; it's the water effect." So what I think is actually happening is the water folds the protein, not the protein folding itself, because as we know now from Dr. Pollack's work, and people have said for thousands of years that water has memory, and it was just laughed at, but there's just too much evidence now. So possibly the information for the protein to fold is contained in the solvent inside the cell. So that makes it even more complicated because the water is participating in this complexity. So that's why the protein folding problem I don't think will ever get solved, because it's too complicated, because people are only looking at the protein. They're not looking at what the protein's trying to fold in. And when you fold little proteins in things like sulfate or try to and unfold them in urea, you're basically it's artificial, and you've taken away the protein's natural environment. And that's a big problem with a lot of biochemistry, is you're taking something out of its natural environment and asking it to do something and then drawing conclusions on that. Whereas how things actually behave in the body, in because you know that there's, we've got the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. So when we've got things doing what they're doing inside a body, it's a wildly different process to taking things out of a cell or a person or an animal and doing things in a lab and then expecting that to be correct. So there's all sorts of problems and things wrong with biochemistry. And I do really want to get my supervisor to come on my own YouTube channel because she was a leader in the field, Professor Radford. But then, I'm not sure how she'd feel if I said all that, but I think you sometimes need an expert to say their bit and then somebody coming and looking at the field from the outside. Because the problem with science is, and nobody disagrees, it's so closed off. You live in this echo chamber and you get isolated from the outside world. So she's probably never heard of Dr. Pollock or lots of study, Jim Al-Khalili, lots of studies on light and how water and protons and deuterium actually participate hugely in protein folding. But I think now, knowing what I know with protein folding, a lot of things like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, I'll use Parkinson's as an example because that's a very dopamine dependent neurological disease. And knowing what I know now about UVA light and melanin and neuromelanin, it screams a lack of sunlight, not a protein folding disease. Because I've worked a lot with people with Parkinson's because I used to teach movement, so I saw a lot of it. And you get to know what people do, and they don't go outside. And but why would they? Because they don't know. And somewhere like the UK, we don't really have that much UV light some of the year, so it would make sense. And then things like Alzheimer's and dementia, there's obviously the insulin resistant side about the insulin resistant brain and the. Because the brain runs slightly, glucose can get into the brain whenever it wants. There's no sort of barrier. It's whether the insulin can get in or not. And then the idea of too much blue light and non-native EMFs pushing up blood sugar would also make sense for more dementia. But then non-native EMFs themselves are going to wreak havoc with mitochondria. And we all agree that mitochondrial diseases are at the root of lots of neurodegenerative disease or cancer. So it does all, or no matter how I think about it now, it all comes back to mitochondria and light and deuterium and exclusion zone water, because the brain contains the most exclusion zone water. So whether it's part of the brain's battery, and that's why sort of ketogenic diets help epilepsy, because ketogenic diets make more water and deplete deuterium. And deuterium has a different dielectric constant to hydrogen when it forms water. So maybe it's just a water effect. The more I think about it, things do just loop back over and over and over again to this to quantum physics. But then it would make sense that quantum physics is like mathematics. It's the most powerful science we have, and we've saturated biochemistry. Like even me, that did biochemistry for 13 years, I pretty much have done every possible technique that there is. And we are just trying to milk the biochemistry, and there's nothing left, if that makes sense. We need to change the paradigm and maybe look at using light as a way to alter gene expression or the microbiome for healing. And I think, the pharmaceutical companies and supplement companies won't give up for a long time, but I just don't often see how anymore these things work, including protein folding. I'm not saying that amyloid doesn't exist, and I'm not saying that it's a disaster if the proteins don't fold up properly. But then the other important thing about protein folding is when they're open or unfolded, that's when all of their tryptophans and tyrosines are exposed. So they fluoresce. That's how we study them. And looking back now, God or the universe or whatever put those kind of amino acids inside, not for us to be able to do biophysics experiments. It's because the protein unfolds and it's going to shine more light, whether it's half folded or fully folded. So straight away, a protein that's folding or folded or half unfolded instantly is like a dimmer switch on a light bulb. So it does make sense that there's a huge light component in why proteins fold and unfold, and it's a sort of communication method. And for sure, proteins unfolded give off a huge amount of light, and that could be sort of part of a distress signal saying, "Hey, we've got loads of unfolded proteins here. Can you come and help?" So again, with the protein folding, nobody says, is the amyloid building up as a protective mechanism, or is the amyloid itself toxic problem. But again, a lot of the times with biochemistry, you know, there are millions of papers on this, yet we've got thousands of papers only on how light and biophotonics are actually functioning in the body. So I just think sometimes it's time to move into a looking at biology through a different lens. But then there isn't the funding for things like water and deuterium and light because it's sort of not trendy because there isn't a large ROI attached and there isn't a product at the end.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I remember reaching out to Andrew Marino a bunch of times, begging for him to come on and chat with me. And he basically sent me a curt email saying, like, you don't understand biochemistry. You think that's how it all works, which clearly it is not. So I can't talk to you if that's the way that you approach things. And he was just very curt with me. And I think he's absolutely right that biochemistry, the way they write about it in the textbooks, is just such a slither of what is really going on. And I remember reading Cells, Gels, and the Engines of Life, which I think is Pollack's best book.
Yes.
And it's so clear, you know, he's using all of this old research, like genuinely old research, not even his own, just showing how the charge on water, depending on how the water is structured, what the bond angles are. And of course, when you're thinking at that level, you have to take into consideration the interaction between water and light. But when that is surrounding a protein, clearly that is the defining factor of how that protein is going to move and engage with its surroundings. It's all about the water that's surrounding it. And that's been fascinating for me to think about because, you see all these old studies showing this that no one ever talks about. But they're there, and you just have to go out and find them. And that's what makes this whole protein folding thing so interesting to me because, yeah, there are all those discussions out there. Is amyloid actually a bad thing? I've seen evidence to suggest that it's an antimicrobial peptide, and it might be there as a safety mechanism as a result of some other damage. And I think, like, there are trials looking into vaccines for all of these misfolded proteins, and so far they've all been disastrous and all stopped very early. And I think we're just looking at it, like you said, from the wrong perspective. We're not taking in the foundational aspects of what it means to be alive and these all of these biomolecules. We're not taking into account all of the major factors that played into how these things came about to begin with. But
Oh no, I
we're
completely agree. Because also back to the idea of the hydration shell, that again is very important for the lock and key hypothesis of how enzymes function. Because it's very crowded in the cell, and just by chance, things can't just find their receptors. And you know, because it would take 10 years for a thyroid hormone to find its receptor. So there's again this idea of the light beacon and resonance, and how there's the quantum effect, same as in photosynthesis. So it can happen accurately and quickly because biochemistry is horrifically slow anyway, and same with neurotransmitters. There has to be something else to help hurry them up, like a beacon to do with light. But also there's people who would say that neurotransmitters are not the way in which we think, or that's not how our brains function, because even if they do have a light beacon associated with them, as in they've got the hydration shell, and then the way in which the light interacts with the hydration shell and the water, that's part of the light. It's still too slow. So there's like fundamental flaws in not just the protein folding, but then that sort of does tie into mental health as well. And yeah, with the one thing I genuinely don't know anything about, and I should do, would be prions and beta sheets, because that was another part of the laboratory. There was different groups, and they worked on the amyloid and the prions, and that seems to have just disappeared. There was a big excitement about CJD and prions, and I just haven't really heard anything about it since. And that's what puzzles me about science. There's a great excitement, and then it just gets forgotten about again, as if the CJD and the prions never happened, and nobody's bothered to pursue it. So goodness knows what that was about. And also the other thing about the hydration shells are, it means with an exclusion zone, lots of things are too big to get through. So that's why with supplements that are saying supposed to be an antioxidant, it's too big, it can't get through. Whereas an electron or a hydrogen can happily cross through, and electrons and hydrogens are antioxidants. So fundamentally, true antioxidants antioxidant or a true antioxidative or antioxidative effect in the body has to pivot on hydrogen and electrons, because they're the only things small enough to be able to pass through these hydration shells. And then so-called antioxidants that you buy, they're just too big.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I just finished reading Nick Lane's book, Oxygen, and he talks about the need for us to redefine what an antioxidant is, because he makes the point that, you know, vitamin C is not actually an antioxidant, because once it reduces something, it itself becomes an oxidant. It becomes the ascorbyl radical, which can interfere, which can play a role in Fenton chemistry and generate hydroxyl radicals as well. In the presence of iron. So we need to be careful about what we call an antioxidant. And I think that's why earthing or grounding has become something that a lot of people really respond to, because I think that's sort of nature's answer to this antioxidant problem.
But also the heteroplasmy rate, as in the more you squash the electron transport chain down, the less electrons can escape out of it. And there are numerous ways to squash the chain. I've just sort of said it very simplistically. But like you said, grounding is the no-brainer one to bring it, and obviously making structured water to drink, and then structuring your own water, as in going outside and near infrared to expand your water battery, but then focusing on anything at any age to keep continuously squashing your own electron transport chain. Because again, like melatonin will compress it, cold will compress it, correct sort of light signaling will compress it, and then confusing signals from EMFs or the wrong food or carbs at the wrong time of the year will open it, and sort of magnetism again is a compressor. So that's also part of it as well, that people fundamentally forget that a big source of these free radicals are the mitochondrial electron transport chain spreading out too much. And yes, of course, it's supposed to happen sometimes. Yep. Like we're supposed to run electrons through complex one and open the chain, same as when we wake up and go to sleep. That's a magnetic or a contraction effect of the collagen. It's normal. It's just to do with, we don't want them spreading out too early or all the time. But that's really interesting that you read Nick Lane's book, because he said he'd come on my podcast, and I need to touch base again, because it's this time of year, he said, because I don't even know where to start with him, of which book to ask him about, because he's got several. But I think the oxygen one, I think that's what you've just brought up now, this misconception about what an antioxidant actually is. I think that's where I might go with him, because it's again something, it's so ingrained in people's brains about these supplements and antioxidants. I think you just need somebody like him to walk people through it, like someone believable who's written books on it.
Yeah, I'm so jealous. I've been reaching out to him for years and never heard back. So you'll have to give me his real email address at some point, because he's probably my favorite writer. And you know, he points out in The Vital Question that when you're at that quantum level in the mitochondria between those respiratory proteins, even bringing them one angstrom closer increases the tunneling effect by a factor of 10, which is like just unfathomable. So, and it's crazy to think that the mitochondria, the best estimates now suggest that the mitochondria are running at about 50 degrees Celsius. And we know that water under heat shrinks, which is unlike everything else. Everything else expands when it's hot and shrinks when it's cold. Water does the opposite. And I think that's a big part of what's happening. We've got all these beautiful coherent water with coherent domains inside the mitochondria that is hot. There's a lot of infrared light spewing out of the mitochondria, making this water like you said, shrinking those respiratory proteins and preventing the leakage of electrons out of the mitochondrial respiratory chain. And ultimately that is anti-aging. You know, forget about what David Sinclair is talking about. At the end of the day, stopping the electrons from getting out of the chain and making sure they go through properly, that's the ultimate anti-aging advice. That's the ultimate thing you can do, because that's going to prevent the most damage and slow the aging rate as much as possible.
Oh, yeah, definitely, because I'm a big fan of cold thermogenesis. And I think in the beginning, when you explain to people, when you heat mitochondria, you heat water and it compresses. They don't understand. But then if you say, well, what happens when you make ice? It expands. And they're like, oh yeah, I get it now. That's what I mean about a lot of this is all actually really simple, because I always say anything to do with resonance transfer, everything in quantum physics, the closer you are, the better. The distance is key, and the smaller, the better. But that's basically how quantum physics has transferred itself into nanotechnology, because it's all back to the smaller and the closer, the better, the more, the bigger the quantum effect. So it kind of mirrors itself in our mitochondria, because I've started talking about mitochondria as microprocessors now as well, because it does make sense to me about, and I say to people, the smaller the iPhone, they've got smaller over time and better. So you want your mitochondria squashed in, and they'll function better. Because I think sometimes with people, because obviously you're a super smart guy, that you can absorb all of this first time. But I think transferring the information to the general public in a way that A, they can understand, B, they can believe, and C, they can do is really important. Because like you said, it's not difficult to do any of this, but sometimes the explanations that, I mean, if my mum and dad tried to read Nick Lane's book, I think they'd get 2 pages in. I found Oxygen a hard read.
A hard read. I'm a very slow reader as well. Transformer was the most difficult for me to get through because chemistry is not my strong point. I'm getting through Power, Sex, and Suicide now. It just
Oh, yeah.
enthralling read. It always used to bug me in chemistry when they'd write, the equation for a series of your reactions, and there'd just be an arrow pointing from one to the next. And I used to think,
Oh,
what do you mean just an arrow? Like, how does it get there? Like, it's what you're just saying, it just happens. How does it just happen? And once I read Life on the Edge by Jim L. Khalili and John Joe McFadden, there's a part in that book where they talk about how biological systems overcome the notoriously incoherent space that is the inside of a cell, and they seem to be using these vibrational and resonance and frequency phenomena to sort of cancel out any of the vi other vibrations that are going on to create quantum states inside of the cell. And I think that is really where we need to start looking with regards to how biochemistry is going on, because I think at the end of the day, we are talking about fundamental particles, so we have to think about this in a quantum manner. Maybe not from the outset, but once we get to a plausible idea of how it's working, we need to start put our quantum hat on and start thinking about how these things are actually working. And the fact that our bodies are going to enormous lengths to create quantum coherent states inside of the body, so that these things can happen, so that we can do the impossible, basically. It's fascinating to think about.
oh no, I agree. And I think that also ties into explaining to people about different kinds of electromagnetic radiation, as in everything's already noisy and confusing in the body, and it may not actually hurt you and you don't feel anything, but inside it's just like being in a noisy room and you're trying to read and there's people making noises, and it doesn't hurt you, but it over time it just irritates you and you can't do things as well as you could. And I completely agree that the way you kind of phrased that was excellent. I do know the bit you mean in the book about it's so messy inside the cell and noisy. How does it how can we have order? How can the orchestra play properly? I think he used the analogy of the orchestra as well in there, but I think that's where it's really interesting. But the thing is, I don't find that complicated to explain or to understand. But then looping back to Nick Lane's book, I actually read the mitochondria book first, The Sex and Suicide, and found that. I've not read Transformer. What's that one about?
Transformer is all about basically carboxylic acids and how the Krebs cycle can work in reverse. Big implications for cancer research. I think that's where a lot of it was going, talking about things like the accumulation of fumarate. I'm probably getting this wrong. It's been a while since I read it. I read it as soon as it came out because I was waiting for it. But yeah, basically about how all of these reactions of the Krebs cycle can work in reverse, and that Krebs cycle can, build matter as well as break it down. That was the one that most went over my head because I, I'm not technically skilled in that area, but the writing, Nick is a phenomenal writer, very eloquent, and I've found everything of his to be extremely, extremely informative. Even if it goes over my head a little bit, you end up grasping the big picture because of the way that he writes. Yeah, and I think Transformer, the information in that, if you were probably you'd probably take a lot more from it than I did. The implications of that in cancer is probably not going to be lost on you at all.
But I think it's really important because a lot of people don't understand or forget that the methylation cycle is tied to the methionine cycle, which are dependent on sun and sulfation. I mean, of course, there's the MTHFR SNP, but that doesn't really mean anything. And if those two cycles are not running properly, it's not really an MTHFR gene problem. It's usually the TCA cycle's blocked with deuterium and it's trying to be linear. And that's where the problem is. And people will try and take B vitamins. And even though, yes, a B vitamin is a cofactor for some of these reactions and for sulfation, the actual, it's kind of the problems, it looks like the problem's here, but it's actually starting somewhere else. And people don't look in the Krebs cycle. And fortunately, you can do an OAT test. So, because a lot of the time with people, I've moved away from theory now. It's like everything I want to talk about with a person, I always want to say, well, if you're interested in deuterium and TCA cycles, you can go and test yours. And if it comes back horrible, here's what to do now. Because otherwise, it becomes all of this like fancy science. And the people are like, well, so what? How does this stop me from getting cancer? Or how will this make my bipolar better? Or I still can't sleep. I've read those three books you told me to read by Nick Lane, but. So it's also all about, but the thing is, the vital thing about Nick Lane is it provides validity and an explanation that can't be argued with, and that satisfies me and you, and then and other people. I mean, obviously Dr. Cruise is very big and he's spread lots of vital information in this and brought it to all of us as well. He's able to sift through crap and bring out gems, and again, he was the one who told me a lot about Nick Lane and said, oh, you must get him on your podcast. And it's all about validity. So that people are like, hang on, this is right. But then I now need somebody else to show me or help me transfer this into my daily life. But the other infuriating thing about it is, no matter what Nick Lane writes about Krebs cycles or Dr. Borosh or Dr. Gaba Shomali, nobody takes the slightest bit of notice about the deuterium and the TCA cycle for cancer, because they have their own ideas. And that's why I brought up the Human Genome Project first. They're still beating that drum.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're. I've heard you mention. I'm not sure if you're a huge fan, like I am, of Rupert Sheldrake. And
Oh, I love Rupert Sheldrake. I adore him. I've read all of his books. Yeah.
he's my idol. He's my. I think he is, to me, he is what the ideal scientist is. Someone who is, so genuine and so interested in discovering new things. And yeah, he's really my scientific idol. And I remember him telling a story. I can't remember the gentleman's name who funded the Private Genome Project. And he's
Yeah.
got a famous line saying, I made $1 million the hard way by
Oh,
working my
yeah.
way down from a billion. Because
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yes.
the Human Genome Project was such a failure because we very quickly began to understand that genes don't mean what we thought they meant. And I mean, to my eyes, all genes do are code for proteins, which cannot tell you anything about form. You can't tell what a house looks like just by knowing what it's made of. So how could you possibly tell, what form something is going to take based on the genes that it has? And I'm curious to get your idea as to what emphasis should be placed on an individual's genetics when it comes to their health. I know guys like Jack Cruise almost never talk about genetics, and I have quite a soft spot for that because I think that's the obvious place to start, is not talk about the things that you can't change. But what are your thoughts on genes? Obviously we're a species that has bred quite largely across different different parts of the world that might have had different polymorphisms for their own environmental niches, and now we're all sort of mixed in together. Are genes something we should be taking note of and looking into, and what impact do they have on our health?
I think it's really important because actually my degree was genetics and biochemistry, even though what I learnt, I disagree, I don't believe, believe my own degree anymore, but I'll happily say that. Because I think with Rupert Sheldrake, he also talks about the non-heritability problem where, we can't account for sort of 80% of what we inherit anyway. So there has to be another medium. But then I'm just going to go off on another like route of there's so much more to this morphic fields and genetics because I'm massively into things like the zero point field and the ether now because it's another medium for information to be transferred through that has been, I was listening to something to do with the Bhagavad Gita earlier and then some other Hindu sort of scripts and things like Brahma and our ancients have been talking about this medium forever and then physicists have studied the ether but because it's inconvenient mathematically they try and get rid of it all the time and this idea of the morphic fields it wasn't just Rupert Sheldrake who talked about it it's come up time after time in different forms so I actually think now that the ether and the zero point field telepathy, quantum effects, distance healing, third to fourth dimension transitions are all the same thing. And so when it comes to transferring information, the genes now to me, I'm even more confused of what they actually do because I also look, I've been looking into Dan Winter's work and I'm interested in toroidal fields and the heart making torus fields and cosmic towers and chakras and the DNA itself, there's the golden angle in it and their little toroidal fields all of their own. So there's a lot more going on than just this idea of making RNA, which then gets made into a protein. So they do hold information, but I think it's sort of more electromagnetic information. So that's the problem now is that yes, we've got all of this data to talk about MTHFR or COMT for making dopamine or breaking down dopamine, or whether you can make vitamin D easily, or can I detox estrogen fast, and should I use HRT or not? It's the problem is that it still depends on the environment because I obviously know my own genetics and lots of my clients. So I'm just thinking about, yes, sure. Okay. I've got a slow COMT gene. So obviously I break down dopamine slower theoretically, but that doesn't mean I am how I am. It's like horoscopes that once you start looking at your genetics and you see all these different things in them, you can think, oh yeah, well I'm like that because of that. And then you get the, because if I look at like horoscopes or my star sign, I think, oh, I match that one more than any other because there's some strange sort of connection thing. And I think sometimes with genetics, when you really go through, people start to see things or they attach meaning to stuff in the genetics that isn't real because it could have come from all kinds of, it could be who they're married to, it might be what they eat, it might be what kind of light they're exposed to. Of what, I could have lots of dopamine because I never have any blue light around myself and I always go out in the UVA and it's nothing to do with my genetics. But then, I think it's interesting, and I just think it's a tool, not a rule. And I wouldn't dismiss it with people. Like I'll humor them, but I still fundamentally think that I don't want to say to people like I don't think you should live here because it does. Sometimes it can sound racist. That's the other problem because Dr. Cruz or other people happily say, "Oh, look, mate, you're from this part of the world and you're living in the UK. Why don't you move back?" And that sounds very racist and that's very offensive to people who don't understand and it can be a massive turn off. However, I do think it helps people because there are people that just need more light than others. Like if you look at the vitamin D SNPs, there used to be something like 12, and I think there's probably 40 or 50 now. And for somebody like that, it's like, look, I'm sorry, you're just going to have to sunbathe naked, or you're going to have to use a mega sun that's got like red bulbs in it as well, because otherwise you're going to have a problem. That's the light ones I go for. And then the dopamine one I always go for because it gives me quite quite a lot of pivot point. If somebody keeps telling me they've got depression and they've got a fast COMT, I'm going to be all over them with the blue light and the UVA rise and say, okay, well, you already burn through your dopamine quicker than other people, so get off the phone, change the screen red, and you need to go out in the UVA more than everybody else. And that's, I've looked at your genetics, and that's, that's what I suggest. So that's how I tend to now look at it. I'll try and find a quantum biology reason of why I want somebody to do something. When it comes to BRAC genes and cancer, I tend not to get involved because I have friends who found they've had a BRCA2 gene, even though I know it's just a DNA helicase repairing gene. And even if you chop your breasts off, the chances are you can get a cancer somewhere else. I'm not going to say that. And it's blue light in the environment. But with somebody like that, they're dead set on removing the breasts. And I just sometimes think it's just better not to say any. I mean, can say something, but it's like they're moving and being racist. People can get really upset. So I think it just depends on how you say it, and it depends on which genes. And yes, of course, people go very excited about the MTHFR gene. Oh, I've got the gene. I've got an MTHFR gene. That's why I've got all these problems. And when I look at their lifestyle and their diet, I think, no, that's why you've got all these problems. And also because of the B vitamins, yes, on a biochemical perspective, you could see how they could act as cofactors, but they're such common supplements and such easy to get nutrients. I just don't think people, it's not a vitamin B problem. When it comes to things like Huntington's disease or these polyglutamine expansions, I think Friedreich's ataxia is another one, because I used to have a client with that. Apparently, even if you've got a long expansion, because people say the longer the polyglutamine, the longer the polynucleotide expansion, the worse the disease manifests. But I think even with that if you manage to live in the best possible environment, even if you discovered young you had Huntington's and moved to the best possible environment for everything else in your genome, I think there'd be a good chance of it not manifesting.
Yeah, that I think that's such a great way to
Because
look at it. I mean, in some sense, weirdly enough, the genetics can be a more superficial level to be looking for answers. And I completely agree because I've got MTHFR SNPs as well. But at the end of the day, it's the environment that's controlling expression of genes, not it's not the other way around. I wanted to ask you about melanin. I've been thinking about this a lot ever since I got really interested in Scott Zimmerman's work and its relationship to light. And I was a bit interested to learn at the end of last year when I was talking to Nina Jablonski that when you go out and get a tan, the darkening of the skin that happens on that day is actually not from new melanin being created. It's actually melanin that's already there at its lower layers of the body, and it comes to the surface. And then later on, melanin gets made in higher amounts. But the melanin that you see more immediately when you start to tan was already there. It's just at deeper layers. And you get to thinking, well, everyone thinks that melanin, the only thing it does is absorb UV light and protect, the genetic material from UV light. If that was true, there'd be no reason for it to be anywhere else in the body except just on the surface. But clearly that's not the case because it's coming from much further down up to the skin when you're tanning. And, we know the substantia nigra is black because even though it's in the middle of the brain, essentially, where no UV light should be, it's covered in melanin. So it's clear that melanin is doing a lot of other things other than just protecting the genetic material on the skin from UV radiation. What else, from your understanding, is melanin doing that is so critical for health?
Well, first of all, it's like a great semiconductor. And then also it can, that in the presence of UV light, it can split water into electrons, molecular oxygen and hydrogen. So this is now back to the hydrogens and the electrons and the antioxidant effect. But also oxygen being the terminal electron, acceptor in the electron transport chain. This is now back to David Sinclair, because he was right about hypoxia, that if pseudohypoxia is a factor in aging, so if we don't have enough oxygen to receive the electrons, that's aging. Hence, yeah. Smoking cigarettes is aging, but other reasons, but also it steals the oxygen. I can't remember he's called Dr. Jose. The doctor that wrote Human Photosynthesis. I think it's something like Soleus. I've said it wrong, but he says that the purpose of melanin is, because it's around all cells, including the mitochondria, is to deliver oxygen to cells and mitochondria. And then Dr. Tom Cowan, I recently heard him say there isn't any oxygen in the blood. That's another thing I'll go into. So that reminded me of do you know his name, the doctor who wrote the book Human Photosynthesis?
I know of him, but I stopped pursuing his work.
Jose Soleus or Jose Serrera, or it's something like, and I don't want to do him an injustice. So that got me thinking, well, I wonder if it's not just electrons and hydrogen, because that would make sense. It's basically providing energy for wherever it is, because of course the substantia nigra needs lots of energy, and it's like a hub of, melanin's an excellent semiconductor, so it's a hub of communication. So that ties in with what Professor Crawford says about DHA also being an important semiconductor, so the information transfer in the brain's organized. It's not just random bits of electrical impulses spraying all over the place.
That's quantized.
The idea of DHA, each electron that goes down the system, it contains specific information and it knows exactly where it's going. And then something like melanin, which is an excellent semiconductor. And there are other semiconductors in the body as well, all a part of our sort of biological computer. So I think the melanin is very important in the the quantum computer idea in the brain. And it would make sense that there's a lot in the substantia nigra. And I think Parkinson's also, the basal ganglia gets heavily affected. And that's sort of the part of the brain that filters information out of the frontal cortex through the rest of the body, so that it's organized sort of in a simplistic way. Because when the substantia nigra fails, the results are catastrophic. So whatever happens in there, it's a very important processing point in the brain, so you would need a very good sort of semiconductor system. And again, if melanin can make water, because also the other thing people say is that melanin can recreate water, it can make water again from electrons, oxygen and hydrogen, so it's a two-way system, right. And if everything in the brain pivots around exclusion zone water, because I was saying that's where the most exclusion zone water in the body is, in the brain, that the melanin's ability to make and break water, that provides not just easy water, but then if electrons or protons or oxygen are needed, it can provide that. And then when in terms of binding biochemical molecules, it can sequester things like certain heavy metals and pollutants. And you're completely correct that melanin doesn't just sit anywhere. It's constantly being renovated and moved and built and shuffled about. Because a while back, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I did some experiments with the melanotan 2 peptide. This is before, if no matter what people tell me not to do, I'll still do it. And I noticed the same thing as you. I thought, hang on a minute, this is impossible. Where this melanin has arrived from somewhere. And I went out in the sun and then it arrived 3 days later. It didn't get made today. It got made in elsewhere, and now it's arrived. And that's when I began to think it doesn't sit anywhere. It's moving about. So I also think maybe the melanin moves about to go where it's needed, because electrons and hydrogen will go where they're needed in the body. Whereas if melanin's constantly being renovated and moving about, how do we know it doesn't just get moved to where it's needed? Because a particular area might need more water on a particular day, or there might be some heavy metal somewhere, or something might require more electrons or hydrogen on that particular day. So this idea of the melanin renovation, and I've heard Dr. Cruz talk about melanin remodeling and melanin renovation, but he never expanded on it. He just said things like autism and stuff. I asked him a question. He said, "Oh, it's the melanin renovation that's important too, not just making." And I know a lot of melanin renovation happens when we sleep, and I noticed that myself with the weird behavior of skin changing color, like even when there hadn't been any sun for ages for it to happen. So it had to have done it somewhere itself inside. So I think that's again a really interesting subject of what's it doing. But it would make sense. It's got so many useful properties. If I was a body, and it's like an army or a police force, I think the melanin gets moved around depending on where it's needed. And the less you have, certain tissues and parts of the body are going to have to suffer. And our bodies rank everything, like all of our reactions and body parts are all ranked. And whichever one, we don't have enough energy to run, it just pushes them to the side, and it has a core reactions that it'll run, and it favors others. So if we lose, say, 10 chemical reactions, we don't notice. But when it comes to 1,000 not running properly, then we notice disease. So I do think there's this idea of the melanin moving about to be able to run or assist with reactions, and we only notice disease when we're seriously sort of like pretty low on it. But I don't know, I'm just speculating now, but I think it does a lot more than people think.
Yeah, I do remember Rick Rubin remarking in a podcast about how he got noticeably whiter and more pale after long haul flights. And I think I noticed the same thing as well, a depigmentation on the surface after long haul flights. And that kind of makes sense in this sort of migration idea that melanin is going where it needs to be at certain times. And we all know that long haul flights or flying in general is an incredible stress on the body. So I guess it makes sense that melanin is getting the hell off the surface to do other things elsewhere, when you're put in a situation like that.
But also, it can break down into things like thyroid and dopamine. So if you haven't slept very well, because that's when we replenish dopamine, and I've had this loads of times, you think you're going to feel terrible the next day, but you feel amazing because if you've got a nice juicy supply of melanin, you just break a bit down and have a little bit of extra dopamine. And there are even studies, I've known about this for ages, that you can sometimes depression's alleviated from a little bit of sleep deprivation. And it's like if you've got enough melanin, it can be. Because the pathway it belongs in is in the same one as the things like serotonin and melanin and sorry and dopamine. It's
Melatonin.
those catecholamine pathways. There are other things it's sort of looped into, thyroids in there,
Yeah.
tryptamines, things like that. So it can actually be made into something useful. And I'm pretty sure there are accounts of people who've got thyroid hormone that don't even have a thyroid gland, and they don't take medication. So where did it come from? And melanin is the thing that the precursor that so it's not just a source of electrons and hydrogen and being a semiconductor, it's also a source of biochemical, like neurotransmitters and hormones. And the thing about the depression and the mood and the dopamine, lots of people have said that they felt that, unexpectedly perky after a bad night. And years ago, I remember someone called Amber O'Hearn talking about this, just saying, "Oh, actually, studies have shown that sleep deprivation can alleviate depression," because I knew she suffered from bipolar and she was very much in the carnivore movement, but she was a very analytical woman that used to go deep into very big rabbit holes, and she was a mathematician as well. And it stuck in the back of my mind for about 4 years. And then when I got into melanin, I thought, "Oh, that makes sense. I've heard this before, and there are studies. So may this is would make sense to me." And then for certain, I've heard about the tan fading. And then in the winter, if you've got made enough tan in the summer, then you've just got a supply of dopamine to not get, depression in winter because you've got your own supply. So again, it serves other purposes.
That's so fascinating. I've always wondered why. My sister lives in Denmark, and her partner is very tan, and he's Danish from way back, and he gets as tan as me. And I always wonder how are these guys getting so tan in the very short summer period that they have? And yeah, it's like it's a reservoir of what they're creating on their skin to last them throughout winter. And in a way, melanin seems to be breaking down into multiple things. It's just like POMC, being, you know, being able to be broken down into all of these other different things when needed.
Then
I'd love
POMC
to.
is tied into all of the leptin-melanocortin pathway with melanin as well, because it's kind of the end of it's, you know, it's not the end of the line, but it's looped in. So, but then again, POMC, melanin's purely a UVA sort of, that's part of, you know, obviously linked to MSH, alpha MSH, which again is one of POMC's cleavage products. But then POMC, it sort of will be cleaved into different peptides depending on what frequency of light it's exposed to. So it's definitely, it's like a massive system, and I don't fully understand it yet, but I think I sometimes have to unpack things one bit at a time and make sense and usage of them, and then pass it on to people, because there comes a point where information, it might be interesting, but it's not practical. But then back to your sister's partner in Denmark, it's not so bad, the weather in Scandinavia, and also they're very much into sort of nakedness and stuff like that. So, and also, it's like the UK. If you know how to milk the cold, you know, I like it when it's really cold. I don't like it right now because it's neither cold nor very light, you know, around the equinox time. But then loads of people's mental health goes down the toilet in October and March. It's sort of, the statistics don't disagree with that, because it's neither one nor the other. That if you haven't got light or cold, you're stuffed in Scandinavia and the UK, because if you can't use the sun, then you just have to make your own UV yourself by cold exposure. So I think the Scandinavians can do that if they sort of pull their finger out. Same as us here in the UK. We've got plenty of opportunities to get really cold. It's just whether you want to take your coat off and do it.
Is it known that the cleavage of POMC into its different biogenic amines, is that a wavelength dependent process, or is that sort of speculation at this point?
I think I read a paper quite recently, because I was, well, it's the 2018 paper, because it had a picture and I wanted to show my clients, because people have heard the word POMC and don't know what it is. And it was actually had like a picture of POMC, and it had scissors. And one of the scissors, it said, this is like in UV light and full spectrum. And it showed scissors, and then it just produced it what it should have produced, because it produces CLIP, which is an insulin secretagogue, and ACTH, and then it produces alpha MSH, and enkephalins, endorphins. There's some other things, lipotropin, like for fat metabolism. And then there was the next diagram. It had, like, I sort of modified a bit with blue light, because it just wrote it in the text. And if you have the rest of the wavelengths missing and just the blue wavelength, there's a disproportionate amount of it gets made into ACTH and CLIP, because the paper was about how light and cortisol are linked. So it's not disputed that if you sit in blue light, your cortisol goes up, and it's this pathway would make sense. So what the paper, what the picture was showing, is if you go outside, you make things which reduce your pain, make you less hungry, and make a tan. If you sit inside, that the same thing gets cut into something that makes your cortisol go up and your blood sugar go up. And that wasn't the main sort of, when I finished reading the article, it didn't announce this like a trumpet. It just happened to have a picture there. Whereas if that had been my paper, I would have been shouting about it. And then, so it's something that if you work, it's, say for me, that's really interesting, insulin resistance and cortisol and sleeping and stress and stuff. It's really exciting to me, but maybe to the people that wrote the paper, they didn't, they weren't as excited as I was about it. So yeah, there's definitely, you know, I'm sure there's a lot more that I don't know about, that, you know, if I don't know what happens to POMC if you sit just in red light, because Scott Zimmerman and I've got big reservations about sitting in too much red light and red
Oh,
light
yeah,
panels. Because for me, I
absolutely.
just think, well, there's nothing wrong with blue light. It's just because it's by itself, and it's a single wavelength. Whereas if you're going to go and sit under a green light, I'm sure something weird would happen. You can buy amber LEDs. They're quite rare, and they definitely do something. I'm sure if I sat under that, I'd trigger some strange level of a hormone, and I might like it. I don't know. And then same with the red light. right. It's something, yes, it might lower blood sugar, but then for people who binge eat, if you lower their blood sugar too much, then they'll go off and binge eat. So it's one of these things that we just don't know. And that's what I was saying earlier, that I think the root of sort of future biochemistry in medicine is working out how does light make things happen in the body, and how do we use it in a safe way. But I don't think humans are capable of that, because all we do is we find, oh, red light does all of these things, therefore we must make loads of red light, and then we all sit in red light. And I've asked Scott myself, well, what does green light do? What about orange? And he's like, oh, we don't really know much about
Yeah,
them. I said,
we
well, it
don't
must
know.
do something because it's there. What happens if I just sit in front of a yellow light panel? Because everything's there for a reason, especially all of the visible spectrum. And we tend to think red's like the best, and UV, I love UV, but maybe I love it too much and think it's more important than it is. And I love in near infrared like Scott does, but that it's all important. That's the whole point. So I just
Yeah.
think it's a really exciting kind of time to study. But then the sad thing is there's just sometimes not the money to study all of these things.
Yeah, it's a real shame. Have you heard of Jacob Lieberman's work with syntonics and color therapy?
Yes. When I did Z Health, this is ages ago. You mean different colored glasses for different
Yeah,
effects?
and everyone
Yes.
responds differently to different types of monochromatic light. And I remember asking, God, who did I asked Jalal Khan. I met up with him, and I said to him, I'm really worried about blue blocking glasses because I bet there are people who respond negatively to monochromatic red light. And he said to me, you might be onto something. And my belief in monochromatic light of any color has really dropped off since speaking to Scott. And I'm trying to use the broad spectrum filament bulbs now, just because I think there's all likelihood that there are going to be people who respond negatively to monochromatic red light. And from a circadian point of view, it makes a whole lot of sense, but maybe there are other considerations that need to be taken into account as well.
Oh, definitely, because I know if you use too much red light on muscle, it can cause fibrotic effects. And then if you work with
Wow.
people with MS, that's not pretty with red light. I mean, you have to start off with something like 15 seconds, or
Yeah.
just use the Bond charge, the little portable, or sometimes just using one of those old-fashioned chicken lamps, like a
Yeah.
really old-fashioned red light for them, because the LED just is, it just causes so much free radicals. It just
Yeah.
is horrible, and their body hasn't got the capacity to cope. But it's also, it's one of these things that is just trying to say that one wavelength of light is superior than the other, and they all matter. But I actually don't think it's anything to do with that. I think also it depends what's in the background. Like really, for using a spurtie or a mega sun sunbed, I should really have it outside with the lid open
Yeah.
and be grounded, because it's yes, there's, I could go on for ages about like UV A and B, and I know Scott's not a fan of it like I am, but I've just said that there's too many problems of not enough of the UV
Yep.
in this country that it warrants usage, because if you don't use it, it's worse. But using it just in a closed room with the lid down, even if you've got red and orange bulbs in, really you should have the lid open, the sun, and then yourself grounded, and then it would probably be really safe. I mean, at the moment, it's not unsafe to use a UV, but the thing about UV is they're all still bulbs. So even Aspertes, the entire UVA and the entire UVB, it's like from, I think, like 300, probably no, 250 all the way up to 300.
Yeah.
Whereas I've got a red light panel, and I've got a four wavelength one. So I've got, I think, 600 and 650, and then I've got 800 and 850. So that's
Right.
rare to have four, but still it's tiny. It's like nothing compared to all the possible red light. So why are those frequencies superior to any other of in that?
Yeah, I mean, it's
So
because I remember talking to Glenn Jeffrey about why 670 nanometers? And he just said that's what everyone else in the literature was using, so that's
yeah.
why we used it. So there wasn't really a a decision. I think it was just one that happened to work once, and then people started to use it. It also happens to be the wavelength or thereabout that plants photosynthesize with, which I
Yeah,
think is quite interesting.
and also there's where hemoglobin absorbs, and then what spins the ATPase. So I can understand that, but it's all back to why even just red? What's wrong with just picking something at, 550 and see, that'll do something. But also there's like just in the visible, aren't there, isn't there something like 10 to the 36 possible combinations of wavelengths of individual each nanometer? So just like the four we've mentioned, it's like a drop in the ocean of light. And you'd spend the rest of eternity trying to test all of those wavelengths individually because it's impossible. I mean, maybe in the future, if you had like, you'd have to do it sort of with some kind of automation in tissue culture. But then again, it's back to looking at light on cells, not in the whole organism, because it's but then the thing is, I think it's really interesting and it opens the door to new ideas, but I think it will end in tears, like lots of things usually do. But on the other hand, it's I sometimes my patients will sort of say, oh, but I feel so good, after my red light panel. I say, well, yeah, I'd feel good if I use cocaine. It doesn't mean it's any good for me. And it's like, but I want to use my panel every day. And I said, yeah, but most people want to eat cakes every day, so and they feel really good. So, but on the other hand, there are studies and there are, I think it's very helpful for injuries. I've definitely had people get better quicker, especially something horrible like, when people are in agony with their back or something musculoskeletal, it can give the person hope again. But then I think that's more of a water effect. I mean, I'm not closed to it. I'm just not, I'm more about, like people, they're just so big now, some of them. And I just think I agree with Scott, and I've always worried about this of shining it in your face. Even if your eyelids are closed, the near infrared can get, 10 centimeters in. And also children, like again, lots of children run away from red light panels anyway, because they're too powerful. And I think you shouldn't really sniff at the little ones, the really small Bond charge one and the old red light therapy that people have used and had great results with, and just making a gigantic one, and making people feel like what they've bought for $1,000 is no good and they must buy something else for 2,000, and that idea of not being good enough. And it's like, no, what you've got already is like crazily powerful. You don't need, something horrible might happen if you buy one twice as big, and I don't know.
I mean, it's very interesting, and it makes me think of this whole biophoton field. And I asked Michael Crawford, because in his latest entropy paper that he did, they note that DHA absorbs at 240 nanometers, which is UV light that doesn't make it through the ozone layer. Like, we don't get it on Earth. The wavelength is so short and the photon is so powerful. And I remember I asked him, is the fact that DHA absorbs at such a wavelength, is that just a relic of the fact that it evolved at a time when there was no ozone layer, or is it indicating that there are still those wavelengths going on from biological emitters inside the body that it's still interacting at 240 nanometers? And this is something that I find really interesting, and I'd like to know more about, is that the aromatic amino acids also absorb in the UVC range, and I know they were around before we had an ozone layer. So, is in your opinion, is the fact that these substances absorb at such a wavelength, is that just a misnomer, just something, a relic of the past, or are they actually still engaging with wavelengths like that are coming from the human body?
But also with all of these, when you look at absorption, it's like a peak. And even if the peak, even if it absorbs at 240, on the tail, you're going to end up going like in the 280. So even if you've got a tiny bit of tail, that's still enough to activate the whole molecule. So that's why with the tryptophans and the tyrosines, we have shone loads of light on those, for years and years in the lab to watch them fold. And I know full well it's right on the tail end. So even though the peak absorption is something like 250, or 240, it doesn't, you don't need it's it, it, you can sh you c it'll excite on the tail end, but also I don't know, because it's one of these things that it's like the whole as above and so below, that you can interpret however you like, that there's a gigantic sun sort of out there, but then there are lots of miniature suns in their own way down here. Like a mitochondria can behave like a sun, and so could a hydrogen or a deuterium. So it's like we don't know whether we've got the capacity to make the UVC, because we haven't got a detector yet to sense it. Although I was listening, I was watching a presentation by Dr. Rees Mould, because he was doing, he's at the Gaia Institute, because he was collating quite a lot of what we know already about biophotonics, and then he's just done quite a few new studies, and he seems to be one of the pioneers pushing forward the biophotons. So it is, I mean, I don't know the answer to the DHA, but I do, I know that it doesn't matter if its peak is there, its tail is going to be in it's going to be around 280. And there are loads of other molecules like this. There's like vast amounts of them that absorb like this, and I know they'll still be excitable in the UVB, which would be, what's it, 280 nanometers, that most of our fluorometers, because we'd excite at 280 and then collect at sort of things like 320 or 350. So it still works, if that makes sense. It still absorbs and emits, and we have the technology. And like thousands of papers to say this, but yeah, that's a good point. I have thought that maybe they happen to choose to absorb at that peak when there was no ozone layer, but then it doesn't matter because they can absorb it like other ones as well.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And guys like Jack Kruse talk about, amino acids getting like activated in quotes by this, by said light. And it's always been interesting to me thinking, first of all, is that true? And where is the stimulus coming from biophotons? I think biophotons are, it's not easy to dispute the fact that we are emitting biophotons, but it seems quite airy as to what these photons look like, where do they come from, what roles might they be playing in biology, and there are great pictures in Roland Van Wyk's book, of particularly the fingertips from the photomultiplier tubes, shining up from the biophoton emission, and I think it's an interesting thing to think about, particularly when you think about how important touch is, physical touch, and the benefit of being close with people, hugging, cuddling, all seem to have positive effects. And you wonder whether some of that comes from the light that you're sharing with each other, not just these biophotons that may or may not be in the UVC range, but also we're spewing infrared light all the time, which I suspect has a beneficial effect as well. So what's your opinion on sort of the contents of what Jack Kruse talks about with regards to biophotons?
Oh no, I completely agree that there has to be processes in the body that are light driven, like how our immune system, if that exists, or whatever our body uses to defend itself, it chases things around the body, and it doesn't have any eyes, so it has to use must be light that it's sensing. And then that with Rees Mould's work, there's lots of work on mitochondria, and they definitely emit light. But I think from what I was listening to and the latest research, it's definitely not, because Dr. Kruse is very much, this is how it is. Whereas even Dr. Rees-Mould was, this is how I think it is. We just need, to understand more. We need more studies. We need, but that's how scientists are. Because I used to work as a scientist, that no matter how much you believe something is true, you always say possibly could be. We need to consider this. We require better detection. You never say everything in that I'm absolutely certain. But they're obviously funding it. And I wish there were other. They went through the whole history of what. what we know, and it's not a lot, but it's something. It was definitely, this is an emerging field. We've got more people coming on board. And then the next lecture, Dr. Doug Wallace came and was talking about mitochondria, but he was talking about sort of more like electromagnetic effects, which again, that's light anyway. But also back to the thing about the cuddling, that's again back to torus waves and the heart being a giant sort of electromagnet, because it's got all that iron floating, or like vortexing about, and all that water, because water's a dipole, and it's got, you know, obviously DHA in it as well. So the whole hugging, but this is again back to the Rupert Sheldrake and the ether and quantum connections, consciousness. So there's all of that that I consider as well, because I think that's really important and really interesting. And I don't just look at light and water and physics and magnetism, because I know full well there's another dimension to it as well, that people will claim they understand, or people who will claim they understand, but they're not believable, if that makes sense, because they're not a scientist and they claim that they're a like medium or a fortune teller or a magician, and people just laugh, but maybe they are. Because the more I look into how the ether could work, and, you know, spooky action at a distance, like Einstein talked about when he actually was wrong, there is something in the empty space. We're now back into the dark matter problem of, you know, so that's again the same as the ether. So again, yes, of course there's going to be a light thing, but like when I talked to Dr. Gerald Pollack, we talked about giant termites living inside in the dark all the time, because I think there's a huge value and importance of darkness. And that's why I think, yeah, the light's important, but it's impossible for light to function properly without darkness. So again, coming back to this idea of looking at other things like magnetism, which doesn't matter whether it's light or dark, or like, and torus waves and hearts still work whether it's day or night, and we can still sense things with a morphic field or telepathy, whether it's dark or light, actually better usually in the dark when it's quiet. I think it all matters, and I think it's just you know, all of it's really difficult to measure or prove, because we're working with particles or matter or things we either can't measure or we don't even know exactly what they are. I mean, a particle physicist would have a much better idea than I would, but then physicists like my supervisor, who's much cleverer than me, is still extremely closed-minded and only looks at their little world and wouldn't possibly think that biology could be a quantum sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, this makes me think of Dean Radin's work, who I absolutely love, Dean, and his book, Supernormal and Real Magic. I think they're at the forefront of what science should be as well. And I know him and Rupert and Gerald Pollack are all close knit, and they all share their work with each other for that reason, because I think they are on the cutting edge and they're onto something that's tangible, but I don't think we can explain particularly why it's happening, which is why guys like Rupert have evoked this morphogenetic field, this thing that, you know, we can't measure or see at the moment, but there has to be something there. Otherwise, you know, the explanatory power of what we understand doesn't go far enough.
But also this loops right back to the beginning of explaining everything to lay people. That to them, if you talk about telepathy and, have you ever thought of somebody and they ring you? And, you know, sometimes if you and your wife are watching TV, do you both suddenly say this? They'll say, of course we do. It happens all the time. So it's all back to, you know, and there are lots of people that believe in, we just don't talk about it. All sorts of otherworldly stuff. It's just I wouldn't talk about it because I mean, goodness knows what Dr. Pollack and Rupert Sheldrake talk about in private. Because I know Rupert Sheldrake's really interested in angels, and I am as well, and religion and stuff like that, but to a different level. So there's all of this other side of the spiritual practices, and our ancestors were into something. And then we do it as well, but we just pretend we don't, or nobody admits it or talks about it. And even Dr. Zapatero, who I talked about with cerebral spinal fluid, he's definitely some sort of magician. And with Dr. Pollack, there's a huge amount in his head he won't say because he doesn't want to speculate. And then when I was asking him about, you know, how to make weather, he said, well, of course you can make weather. yourself. But then he kind of said, well, I don't want to speculate. So there's all these people that know something but won't openly, outrightly say it. There are other people I know full well, I mean, who I know personally, that just say, well, I can't say it because, it's my profession, but it's real. And like with Dean Radin, he approached it in a very scientific way. And I know that in one of his many books, there's the story about the remote viewing, when he was trying to choose a new location. But then with the remote viewing, that all comes back to the zero point force and Dan Winter's work. And there's great excitement all over again about the Enochian alphabet and John Dee and the maths behind that. So, sometimes we just don't have the right mathematical equation for something. And then when we have it, we dig back up something from the, and I think sometimes we just don't have the way to analyze something or detect it. So I don't, there's lots of things I don't know, but I know that they exist and I can't explain it, but they are real. And same when you speak to the general public, they also say, oh, I know that's real, but I don't care. I haven't got the brain to understand and I'm never going to have it. I just know it's real. So, there's a, and that, I think that keeps me happy as well, because all back to things like joy and, happiness. What's that? What's the wavelength of happiness, or what's the frequency of happiness, or what's the neurotransmitter of happiness? There's all some other kind of, frequency, or like, why is this podcast really fun? Do you know what I mean? It's like there's another dimension to things which like I'm always open to, and that's why quantum physics excites me so much, because that's where I think the answer is.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes me that explanation makes me think of David Hawkins' work.
Oh yeah.
I love how you know everything that I've brought up so far. Transcending the levels of consciousness. What you just said reminds me exactly of his ideas about the basically the frequencies of different emotions and different feelings and where that takes you. I want to ask you about semiconductors. I think it was in the 1940s when Albert St. Georgi basically said he thinks proteins have the capacity to be semiconductors. And I'm not a physicist. I don't think I understand semiconduction super well, although I think I have a rudimentary grasp on how it works. But to apply that to a biological system is quite difficult. And I'm trying to understand how all of these things, it seems to me like the extracellular matrix is like a big semiconductor network because it's made of collagen, basically.
The carbon nanotubes, yes.
And it seems to me as though this is intimately linked with what Robert Becker was talking about with the DC control system inside the body. And
In the bone, because the bone, remember, things can be doped as well, like with a copper doping the bone, and we can have P and N type semiconductors. So I'm not an expert in semiconductors either. I just, like you, I know what they are, and then I can start to identify different ones in the body. Like iodine again plays a role in semiconduction. So yeah, definitely with Robert O. Becker and the bone, that there's no doubt that, but it's more of a diode, isn't it, the bone? And doesn't it emit red light as well? It's like a red light emitting diode.
I was trying to explain this to my dad a few weeks ago, how bone is, for all intents and purposes, an LED because it's a PN semiconductor junction where the band gap is such a width that it emits red light when the electrons jump from the valence band to the conduction band or vice versa. When that happens, you release a photon of light, and the wavelength of light is proportional to the band gap. It's you start to think, well, if you have all of these different semiconductors in the body, all with different band gaps, then you've got basically the whole rainbow being emitted from different semiconductors as the electrons jump between the valence and the conduction band. And
Oh
this
no,
is some.
I completely agree with you. That's why minerals, they all emit a different light frequency, and that's why with Harold Teer's work, the guy with the cosmic tower, I learned a lot about water and minerals and light. and light signatures, because we all have a different light signature anyway, like a
Yes.
DNA barcode. So now,
Yeah.
because this is again, there's numerous places in the body that can create these kaleidoscopes, like the mitochondria can do it, so can the gut microbiome, because
Yes.
that's why POMC is in the gut, because it's the receiver for the light, and the gut's the basically light. And then the bone is obviously going to do semiconduction or make light of its own. The heart obviously is going to do all, goodness knows what that emits, like all sorts. So yeah, there's honestly, I like this, like this is like getting to territory now where I don't know anymore. There's the and then melanin, of course, can create a kaleidoscope.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the other thing about semiconduction and molecules is you can have all these different filters. Like you could start off making light, but then if something blocks or absorbs, that's a way to modulate the frequencies, because everything has to be organized. You can't just blast light out all over the place in the
Yeah.
body. You've got to have things in the way to absorb and emit at specific wavelengths, because that's how the fine tuning happens. So there's another layer again, that's all more complicated, because it's like we were talking about the electrons in melanin and DHA, because obviously each electron's identical in the universe until you charge it with light, and then because of the sort of Jablonski diagrams and the different sort of combinations of information you can get, that's where the information comes from. But then you can't just shine light randomly around the body. You've got to have blockades and things in the way. So again, it's a whole other level again of like, yes, there is a light show going on. I 100% am behind Dr. Cruz there, but I think I'm sure he knows how complicated it is really. He just hasn't got round to telling us, because most people are so behind in the understanding. It's just, I think it's, in partly why he gets the way he is. It's just he's tried so hard with everything to help humanity, and he's presented us with the answer, and people don't want to know. Well, I want to know, obviously. You want to know, and it's, but then it's like, well, how far does this even go? I think he's only just scratching the surface of what he's telling us about what he knows about the light show. But yeah, you're completely correct. The potential for making rainbows and light in the body is just like astronomical.
Yeah, it's like a symphony of light going on at all times. And yeah, like you said, it has to be so well controlled and curated so that it's not just chaos, because clearly our bodies are the epitome of the opposite of chaos. We are complete order, which kind of doesn't make sense if everything is supposed to tend towards chaos. But we seem to be such a well-maintained and functional system of complexity that I don't think we'll ever really grasp, which is kind of frustrating but kind of beautiful at the same time.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it's like the idea of, it gives me, I don't know, it's sometimes I think, like Jordan Peterson always says this, another way to make yourself really happy is to have a really good conversation,
Yeah.
about stuff like this, because it just brings sort of great joy and it opens up your neuronal pathways, and that's always good for you. So I think, again, even if we haven't concluded anything to help people about the light show and how it actually gets modulated or blocked or organized or, structured, the idea that it's there is another just wow, we're not just a lump of meat.
Yeah, well, what a great way to sort of wrap up and
Yes.
let my brain have a rest for a little while. I'm not going to sleep tonight. I'm just going to be thinking about this all night.
Oh no, it's been great. Yeah.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you. You are such a wealth of information, and I love that you're sort of into some of the more esoteric ideas like Rupert Sheldrake and Dean Radin as well. You know a lot more than me, so I've written some names down of the people that you've mentioned so I can read their books as well, because I think that is just as important in this conversation, is these esoteric things, even extending out to spiritual ideas and religion, is all has to be taken into consideration when we're
Oh,
thinking about
absolutely.
all of this stuff.
I'm a massive fan of the Kabbalah and Sufism and everything like that. Angels, ceremonial magic, Sumerians, everything. And there's also all the really deep stuff to do that once you reinvestigate, you can see quantum physics and earth and light. And so I'm open to all of that as well. So, It's but then it's like we were saying, sometimes you can't just say it because it then detracts from the there's a fine line between being taken seriously and then laughed at. And because I really want people to take the physics seriously, I don't want to talk about other stuff I'm interested in. But on the other hand, maybe that's the way to get people interested in it, is to talk about the more sort of spiritual esoteric stuff, because that appeals to people, even if they pretend they're not interested, they are really.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because I used to work in hospitality, and the amount of times you would look around and someone would be trying to get your attention, and you go, "Why did I just look over there? I didn't know they were trying to get my attention." And it happens so regularly that you don't even think twice about it. And because I was aware of it, I would just notice every shift. I'd be like, "Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why was I knowing that that person was looking at me when I couldn't see them? They were right behind me." So. And yeah, it ties into all this quantum entanglement and all this lovely stuff that my brain just explodes trying to think about.
But then also, if the eye is like quantum biology begins in the eye, and so does neurology, how do we know it's not just an input device? How do we know it's not outputting? Because it has to. And then I know what you mean, the sense of being stared at in Rupert Sheldrake book. But now I'm more okay. Well, how do we know? Is it something that the eye projects out and the ether transmits it, and then the melanin receives it? Because I'm sure melanin's part of our receiver, our FM radio station, and the ether's the stuff in between. But how did the you looking at the person get through the ether to the melanin?
Do you know Donald Hoffman?
No.
He wrote one of my favorite books, The Case Against Reality.
Oh, someone was talking about that yesterday.
I think you would love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll leave it at that. Otherwise, we'll have too many books to read,
Yes,
and
exactly.
we'll never get
We'll get
anywhere.
too excited. Yeah, no, I'm gonna go for a walk now because my head's all, oh, this was fun. But that's the whole thing. Good old Jordan Peterson, and they're having a really good conversation. Part of that's one of his 12 pillars of how to be happy.
Yeah, I agree. I had a great time. So thank you.
Thank you. It was brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this one. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you're interested in Sarah's work, I've left links to her website, podcast, and YouTube channel in the episode notes. She also offers incredible courses on a variety of topics if you're interested in going deeper into what we spoke about here today. Sarah also sees clients about health optimization if you want someone like her to help you understand more about how you can live a more healthy and vibrant life. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can subscribe so you get notified whenever I release a new episode. I would also encourage you to leave a 5-star review or give a thumbs up if it's on YouTube if you like the episode. I've also put links to all of my social media platforms in the episode notes if you'd like updates about the podcast, information about health, or if you'd just like to reach out to me in general. So thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.